No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype questions to BBSRADIOPR. And we hope you call in tonight because we have a great guest talking about a topic that's on the lips of everybody in America these days. But first, let me introduce my co-host, Maria Sanchez. Say hello. How are you, Maria?
Actually, pretty excellent, Michael. Thank you for asking. And you mentioned last week something about healing, so maybe you want to let us know how you're doing.
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm just suffering the ravages of old age, and diabetes. I get a cut and it takes 6 months to heal,
I've heard but, that.
Yeah, but diabetes. No serious problems. I got some sort of MRSA infection and it wasn't clearing up, but now it's clearing up. And, if you're out there, don't get old. Get even. I don't know, but
but it beats the alternative.
I know. That's the problem, right? There really isn't a lot you can do about it, except that now, of course, I'm on the New Year's Eve diet and the New Year's resolution diet, and I'm trying to work out, and so we'll see how that goes. But you're on a roll, Maria. I mean, school's going well for you. The Los Angeles Rams are in the Super Bowl.
Yes. Yes, it's quite exciting, and I'm settled and really enjoying the studies and bearing down. I'm going to start my dissertation in September.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, while we're talking about happy news, let me run down real quickly that because we have a great guest tonight, but we've got seven new co-sponsors on H.R. 51, our statehood bill in the House. Tulsi Gabbard, of Hawaii's 2nd District. I love this person's name, Harley Rauda from California. Makes California 36th co-sponsor.
Oh, my goodness. That's three times New York now?
Yes, three times New York. And Harley is from California's 48th District. Max Rose from New York, 11th District. Colleen Allred from Texas 32nd District. John Garamendi, also from California. Yay, California, third. Susie Lee from Nevada's 3rd District, and Chrissy Houlihan from Pennsylvania's 6th District. All members of the House, all Democrats. God bless you all for standing up for the people of the District of Columbia. And now, without further ado, let's bring our guest on. Our guest tonight is Will Warren from Washington City Paper. He's a multimedia and copy editor for the paper. And the paper, during the government shutdown, set up a guide to the government shutdown, everything you needed to know for people in our area. As you know, Maria, our area was particularly hard hit by the government shutdown.
Yes, we discussed that last week.
Right.
About how you were inordinately impacted.
Yes. Well, the Washington Post today says $1.6 billion to the local economy. Now, that's the region, not just the District of Columbia, so that would include Maryland and Virginia. But $1.6 billion it's hurt the economy. So let's get Will on. Will really was at ground zero in some ways with this because of the input to his newspaper. Will, are you there?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for being on the show.
You know, that financial number that you mentioned, Michael, the S&P Global Ratings estimates were that it cost our total economy $6 billion. So that means your effect, again, showed the inordinate amount of pain that you went through, because that your number is about a third of that, right?
Yeah, it is.
And that's, Bill, did you find that to be true, too?
Absolutely. I mean, that's something that our reporters saw time and time again. We have a great team, as I think the senator was saying. We put together a guide for people who were affected by the shutdown, and it was full of ways, both big and small, to sort of help weather the storm. But we were also, of course, reporting on the effects of the shutdown on the city. And I spoke with a number of federal workers and contractors who were affected by the shutdown for our podcast, which maybe we'll talk about that later. But we also were talking to the folks who maybe they don't work for the government, but they are dependent on the government in some way. So we heard from hair salon workers who were seeing half the clients or a quarter, or not a quarter, maybe three quarters of the clients they normally would, Uber taxi drivers who were not seeing the traffic they normally would. So yeah, I mean, it affected the whole region, not just the people that you think about as who are missing a paycheck.
Well, and even what I started to realize when it started to get a picture, you have one person in a household that's affected, that affects the entire household. Regardless of what careers they're in or where they are in life. I mean, one paycheck missing from a household, that's significant.
Yeah, and I don't have the statistic off the top of my head, but I know many people have less than $1,000 in savings. So when you think about that, I mean, missing two paychecks is suddenly an emergency for a lot of people. And that was certainly borne out in food banks and other sort of assistance programs across the region.
Well, you know, I think if there's any good news in any of this, Will, that certainly was the good news, is that we saw so many people, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but we saw so many people that were willing to chip in, you know, everything from some restaurant that was giving workers free tacos and people giving out free coffee to they even had a career day in Falls Church for substitute teachers for people that you know, felt they needed to find a new job. So I thought there was a real outpouring here in Washington. How do you feel, Will?
I think that we saw that too. In addition to copy editing the paper, I host our podcast, Washington City Podcast, and we opened a phone line where people could just sort of call in and share their experiences with the shutdown. And that was a great experience because it really showed the diversity of how, like you're saying, how the shutdown affected the region. So not only were federal workers who were really hurting to miss a paycheck were calling in, some that were more privileged called in. We had contractors call in, just concerned people. And one of those people was a pastor, and he was talking about how they did a missionary collection at their church to try to help pay the bills of some people who were affected by the shutdown. So, yeah, I think you're right that you did see some coming together in the community and a lot of altruism.
And what do you think this has done? You know, today in the Washington Post, a couple of things they talk about are this effect on morale, not only the morale of workers, which I'd really like your input on since you talked to some of them, but also on businesses. The Post seems to think that, they quote a woman that says, "Trust and hope are gone," because she lost the government contract. And her opinion is that contractors will be less likely to work with the federal government or see the federal government as a source of stable employment. Were you getting a sense of that, or people saying, gee, I'm not going to put up with this?
Well, for contractors, I don't know that I can speak to that. I mean, the logic of what you're saying, it makes a lot of sense. And people come to rely and expect on a paycheck, and when that's gone, it makes sense that they would question it. But I haven't been talking to those decision makers, mm-hmm. but I can shout out one of our contributors, Joshua Kaplan, wrote a great piece for us about exactly what you're describing, which is the morale of government workers. And yeah, we heard, or he heard from them, that a lot of them were questioning, you know, what's the point of doing this work if the government is going to tell me I can't do it for a month and actually end up paying me to not do the work. And yeah, they were definitely thinking about, is this something that I want to keep doing? I mean, obviously not all of them, but that's not a, that's a sentiment that we did hear.
I would imagine, though, that you, you know, since this was exceptional and the longest one ever and, you know, a lot of firsts, that it's the aberration. It's the exception, not the rule. So in general, I would feel that it wouldn't affect people's decisions moving forward.
Well, you know, a lot of them went to work anyway. I mean, they showed their dedication. Certainly people like the Coast Guard and TSA employees and people like that. But I would think, I don't know, Maria, I think some of the lower paid people may actually might actually have that sentiment. I don't know. What were you hearing, Will? Was anybody saying that? Was anybody saying, look, I'm going to go look for another job?
Yeah, I mean, you hear both. I think it's always important to be, and this is why people don't like to talk to have journalists on radio shows, so I apologize, but it's important to remember that, you know, we hear anecdote, which doesn't necessarily mean that we have a scientific sample and say that, you know, 51% of government workers are considering finding new work, because there are reasons why people do government work, because it's traditionally stable, it pays well, but yeah, I mean, we definitely were hearing and reporting people. I'm looking at this Joshua Kaplan piece right now. You have someone from the National Park Service that you talked to saying, I'm going to go back to work just to get my back pay, but then I'm considering leaving because this is untenable. I'm too old for this crap. I don't know if I can say that on your show. But
yes, you can.
Yeah. We say it once all the time.
So, yeah, we did hear that sentiment. But we also hear from people who feel that they're, and this is people I talk to through the hotline, they feel that their work is important, and the problem is that they weren't able to do it for this month, and so it's not that they are thinking about trying to find new work, it's that they want to get back to the work that they have chosen to do and to have made their life's work doing. So it's a mix.
Well, and you know what? The thing you said about anecdotal information, that's so important, because that's the bane of the existence of every politician. I don't care what you're talking about. There's always somebody in the audience that has an anecdote, you know, that property values have skyrocketed, but there's always some guy that's, you know, bought a house and the property value went down. You know, there's always one person in the audience that has an anecdote that flies in the face of whatever the conventional wisdom is. So it's very important to remember that. That's true. Unless you have a random sample, you really can't say.
Yeah, but
so
I
imagine we'll get answers to a lot of the questions that we're asking in the coming months if we see suddenly a lot of people are leaving government work, then there's your answer. Sorry, I cut you off.
It's okay, but Will, I appreciate the integrity that you feel with the role that you play, because as a scientist now, and taking a year of statistics, you know, you got to get a good sample to really get a good feeling about making a good guess, if you will. And I don't think I've ever heard it come from your field in that regard. And that gives me hope. I like that a lot. I think it's admirable.
Well, I'm happy to hear that.
I didn't know you were taking statistics, Maria.
Yes.
As somebody that passed graduate statistics, let me give you a little advice. I cried in front of the professor, and I think she upgraded me a grade. So
took it one semester at the master's level. Now I have me to take three semesters at the PhD.
That would have done it for me.
It's
I guess that's why
pretty.
I stopped at the master's level.
Yeah, it's not pretty.
So, Will, you know, what did you learn? What is it that you learned by doing what you did in this situation that surprised you? Is there anything that surprised you that you didn't expect to see that you found out?
Well, I don't know that it's a surprise, but it's always a important reminder, even if it's unfortunate to get it this way, just how many people government work touches. And this is something we saw through national reporting. I think for a lot of people, it's a reminder of how important different government work is. Suddenly, we find out that food's not being inspected, although I think they went back to doing that. But there's all of those ways that the government touches people's lives. But also, like I was saying, how my colleagues had reported on sort of the ripple effect across the city, the way it affected other industries that on their face, you'd think, well, that doesn't have anything to do with the government. Well, it does, because the government's a big employer here. So I think that it's just an important reminder of the way that we're all interconnected, and the suffering of some people really permeates out and can affect a whole city.
Absolutely. Now let me ask you to put on your reporter hat, and because this really perplexes me. I don't know if you have the answer to this. I've listened to all the political pundits on the talk shows today, and none of them had the answer to this. But although it seems that Politico did a poll showing that they're blaming the president, 54% of those polled blame the president, whereas 35% blamed the Congress for the shutdown. Yet in several polls, his popularity seems to be relatively stable. Do you have any insights into that? Why, you know, people keep on coming out in opposition to what this man is doing, but still supporting him?
You know, I'm not sure how much light I can shed on that, as you and I'm sure all of the listeners know. Those numbers don't really reflect D.C., where I think almost 93% of people voted for Hillary Clinton, and maybe 4% voted for Donald Trump. So I think that we're certainly on a different wavelength from the rest of the city, or of the country, rather, in terms of who's to blame and the popularity of the president. So I'm not sure that I can say. Our reporting doesn't usually take us into those lines of thinking of why do these members of Congress or senators seem to, you know, not support the shutdown, continue to support the president. That I can't really comment on.
Well, yeah, and I think that one of the reasons it perplexes me is exactly what you said, that we live in this bubble, you know, where 94% of us voted for Hillary Clinton. That's probably more people voted. I don't think 94% of my family voted for me. So that's a very, very, very high number. And it's hard for us. I think it is hard for us to see because we live in this bubble.
On the left coast.
Yes, on the left coast.
I was talking to a girlfriend of mine today who's from Dallas, and she was talking about how she's seen their state become more purple than ever. She's fifth generation Mexican-American Texan. And I said, well, and then you have me. There were only Democrats on my ballot because we have the top two vote getters that get to be from the primary. And so there's all the elected officials at the state level are all Democrats. So yeah. I was deciding, you know, for attorney general and governor and insurance commissioner. And I mean, you know, dog catcher, et cetera. It's all Democrats.
So back to the subject of, at hand, Will. I think our listeners all know that the government's going back to work, but it's only going back to work for sure for 3 weeks. So,
right, February 15th, any, I think.
Yeah. Any feeling about that? Do you think that politicians have learned a lesson from this experience that they can't shut down the government? I know that there's talk. There's legislation being introduced by Senator Warner from Virginia and from other people to make it so that you can't shut down the government. And we know that there's precedent for this because Washington, D.C. was always shut down when the federal government was shut down, except for this time. And that happened because of a piece of legislation that our delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton got through Congress to keep Washington open even in a shutdown. Do you think these guys are scared enough now from this experience that when they go back up there, they're going to pass legislation that keeps the government open no matter what?
Well, like I said, we're definitely more plugged in, or I won't speak for my colleagues, but I'm definitely more plugged into the local scene. And I mean, part of me is tempted to turn this question around on the politician and ask if you think that our federal elected officials are scared of shutting down the government again. But I mean, I think the way that it dominated the news cycle and like you were saying, it's widely not popular. You'd think that that would lead to at least some momentum to not let it happen again, but it's hard for me to say, at least as a local reporter.
Okay, and then let me ask you, because I'm such a partisan Democrat, I don't think that I can be objective about this, but did Nancy Pelosi really win the battle? I used to work with Nancy Pelosi, so I love her, and my opinion is yes, she won the battle between her and the president. What do you think? You want to speculate on that? Go ahead.
Sure, you know, maybe you've broken me down into speculation a little bit. I think that it really depends on who you are talking to, I'm sure. I think that we're in such a partisan time that it's hard for me to imagine that your answer to that question doesn't depend on who you voted for in 2016, what you thought of Nancy Pelosi 4 months ago before the shutdown was on anyone's mind. So I think that the people who are fans of hers probably say, yeah, she won. And people who didn't or who aren't fans of hers probably think she came out on the losing side, which is, I mean, that's part of the problem. That's why we get to the situation that we're in where the government's shutting down, I think. But it probably depends.
Well, that's the perfect answer, Will. And let me tell you, if it doesn't work out for you in journalism, you need to run for public office, because I think you have a real future, because that really is the perfect way to answer that question. But let me before we let you go, because you've been so gracious to come on the show tonight, what do you want to add? Was there a story that you heard that really touched you that you want to share, or anything else that you want to tell us?
The thing that I would point people to is the biggest project that we undertook during the shutdown, which was our shutdown guide. And I'll point people to that for two reasons. First, I hope this isn't the case, but as you were saying, we don't know what's going to happen on February 16th. So hopefully this isn't a resource that people need to call on again, but it does have places to get free food, utility assistance, the ways to help your neighbors, and then also sort of the things that you usually see people talk about when there's a shutdown for like a couple of days, the free food you can get from like deals from restaurants and things like that. So I'll point to that, but partially as a resource, but also as a log of just all of the myriad ways that it affects people. And if you're someone who's fortunate enough to not have been affected by the shutdown directly or even very much indirectly, just seeing all of the different ways that it touches your people's lives, I think hopefully my hope is that as people read it, it would give them some sympathy and maybe break out of that partisan mindset that, however you feel about the politics that led to this sort of brinksmanship, then at least you can see the way that the outcome affects the workers that we rely on to keep airplanes safe, to keep our food safe, to keep the skies and water clean. So that's the resource I would point people to. And then, of course, the podcast as well is a good resource for all things DC politics, not just the shutdown.
So where is that link, or is it a website?
To the podcast, our website is WashingtonCityPaper.com. You'll find the shutdown guide on there pretty readily, or if you just search City Paper Shutdown Guide. And then the podcast is available wherever you get podcasts. It's called Washington City Podcast, where I host it, and also that's on our website as well.
Perfect.
Yeah, and just to tell you, I looked at the guide. It really is a great thing you guys did, and I encourage everybody to look at it. Just as you say, even if you're not affected directly by the shutdown, it really gives you a sense of how widespread it was, and so I think it was a really great thing for you guys to do, and I really appreciate it. And let me also say that we appreciate the City Paper. You know, the City Paper has gone through a couple of tough times in recent years, but you keep us from being a city with not enough papers. You've done incredible things in the past. You've uncovered corruption in D.C. and other things that other newspapers have ignored or have missed. So you're a great resource, and we appreciate all you do for the community, Will. And thanks so much for being on our show. Do you have any parting words? Anything else you want to leave us with?
Well, no. I mean, thank you for saying those nice things about City Paper. And I guess I just want to pass on the thanks to all of the readers who have supported us throughout the years and what we do. And also to thanks to my colleagues who do all of that great investigating that you were talking about. So thank you very much for having me on. Thanks to the listeners who support City Paper. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Will. Thank you, continued Will. Success.
Okay, so yeah, that was right. It was the story all week, Maria. Especially around here. Go ahead.
My opinion about the question that you asked, Will, about did Pelosi win, if you will?
Mm-hmm.
I see it more as saner heads prevailed. Trump chose to take the wall funding out of the equation for the temporary lifting. And somebody who's in his close circle, Representative Mark Meadows of North Carolina, do you know of him?
Mark, yes, we know Mark very well. He's a DC hater. Go ahead.
So he said, apparently he's in the inner circle, that Trump's opinion of Pelosi, quote, has always been one of a worthy adversary. And so I think it was the compassionate thing to do. There's all these innocent people, 800,000 plus their families, suffering. Let's get the politics out. Let's get business back. And hopefully, saner minds will prevail in the next 3 weeks.
I hope you're right. And I certainly appreciate that opinion. I think that it has a lot of merit. And I hope you're right. I hope that saner minds prevail. I think that I hope, anyway, that neither one of them would look at the situation as a tug of war where they were keeping federal employees hostage as a bargaining tool. And I hope that's not the case. I only mean that when Nancy, I think she put her foot down, she drew a line in the sand. And I think that was important for her to do. And and I'll give it to you that the president responded. He didn't have, we'll see. I think what Will said is really important, that we'll see what happens in the near future. Before the February 16th, I think, deadline, we'll see if now that negotiations have been opened up, how willing both sides are to negotiate. And that's still, that's still out there.
The art of the deal, since President Trump made a concession, that would suggest that perhaps it might be more amenable moving forward.
Yes, I hope. And I hope that's the case. And I hope, look, Marco Rubio was on Meet the Press today. Not one of my favorite people, but he said some very important things, I think, that there's many things that have been drawn into the middle of this fight that are in this battle right now that can be resolved. Things like DACA, for example, there could be a final resolution to that as part of the negotiations that go on with what the president demands is the wall or whatever. So I think that's important to remember this, we may be able to resolve a lot of things. And I think one thing is absolutely indisputable, and that is that border security is front and center right now. That mm-hmm. that whatever solutions, I think there's a difference of opinion on what border security should be, but I think that everyone is pretty much committed to border security. And let me just say, you know, the former co-host of the show, Kathleen Gomez, lived in a border town, and I'm still connected to many of the people in that town through Facebook and other social media platform. And I can tell you, these people are distressed. This isn't, you know, I'm not somebody that's in favor of the wall. I think the New York Times reported that there were over 1,000 tunnels discovered in the last 10 years from Mexico to the United States. So I worry about the effectiveness of it and the symbolism of it. But there's no doubt that people in those border towns, in many of those border towns, feel like they're suffering.
Well, Kathleen, was a guest on our program after I took over. She talked about how it crippled her town.
Yes.
And I think the hospitals were, I think they went out of business.
Yeah, her hospital did. And I think, you know, people have to understand that this is a real problem. This is not a problem in Washington, D.C. for me. You know, I don't have, you know, this is not, I know that when we talk about this problem, we have to put it in context. You know, again, what Will said about anecdotal information, you know, we know most of the drugs in this country are not sneaking in over the Mexican border, but are coming into different ports of entry. We know, you know, we need to think of this thing rationally, but we also need to understand, I think, that these people, I can tell you from the things they tweet out and from the things I see on Facebook, they're not making this stuff up. They're really suffering in some of these towns, and we need to do something about that. We need secure borders. I think, you know, most of us understand that America was built on immigrants, and I don't think we want to stop immigration. But I think we've all come to the point where we've decided we need secure borders. I don't know. How do you feel?
I believe in that too, in having grandparents who came through Ellis Island and both parents who speak English as their second language. I come from an immigrant family with an immigrant mentality, and I mean that very respectfully, because my folks, if you couldn't afford it, you didn't buy it. You know, none of this credit thing. And you know, so that's how I was raised, and that's how, you know, they were taught. But you and I have always spoken, Michael, that even though we have some political differences, how much we agree. And I always say to people, I think we agree on about 85% of most of the issues, with what, especially since we're both so liberal socially. But what I found interesting, you know, the Koch brothers had their biannual meeting this weekend in Palm Springs. Mm-hmm. And so if anybody doesn't know, you have to promise to give at least $100,000 a year to their network, and then you're invited to this event. So last night they spoke, and there were 634 donors in attendance, 181 of them for the first time.
Wow.
And Charles Koch said last night that he thinks that the different beliefs are tearing our country apart, and that the Koch network is about, and this is his quote, working to unite with anybody to do right, which includes refusing to back Trump in 2016 and not going to support him in 2020, and you know, having some contentious exchanges between them, and yet and still they want to support nonprofit groups to promote visions for free and open societies. So how interesting is that, that they've evolved from being one of the largest donors, sometimes outpacing the RNC, and getting more socially conscious and aware?
Well,
because at the end of the day, isn't that really how we make our planet a better place, is taking care of our people and not involving partisan politics in it?
Yeah, I mean, that to me seems to be, you know, an amazing development, because, you know, they certainly, the Koch brothers, in my opinion, have supported some really, really bad things. But they if they're evolving like that, I think that's great. And I got to tell you, the thing with me that I can't get over is the whole respect thing. I think it's all about respect. I respect who you are, Maria. I respect that you've raised several children successfully, that you're over 21, you're still going to school, you're still, you know, out there trying to make yourself and the world around you a better place. So no matter what you think, for me, it all revolves around a basic respect. And I don't know how we've lost respect for each other, but I think that's what's going on in America. I think, you know, you say Republican or conservative or liberal or whatever the tag is that you put on
the category.
Yeah. And then we know everything about you. We don't want to know anything about you. And it's funny because when people touch each other, when they're in close proximity, the people that I think really hate each other on the political spectrum, I think get along. In most places, you know, they get along and they get things done because they respect each other on a personal level. And I don't know how we get back to that. But that's another thing I heard on Meet the Press today. Somebody saying that, you know, why is it that we're so far apart nationally that our Congress can't get anything done? But when we look at our localities, you know, we run schools, we have clean water, we have, you know, public safety, we have, you know, so on a local level, we seem to be able to agree so much more than we do on a national level.
And it's interesting because on a national level is a reflection of the local level, i.e. elections. So you'd think that we would elect people that would represent our values. Mm-hmm. And so where's the disconnect then? Once they get to Washington, D.C., they distance themselves from what they claim to be? I mean, how that doesn't, like, in other words, I'm somebody with integrity, and I know you are too, and you have a value system and morals and beliefs. How do you suddenly change that? Those are kind of fundamental essentials to who we really are.
I don't know that we change them. I think that we ascribe to you many things that are probably not part of you. You know, I mean, if you say I'm a conservative Republican, again, we ascribe all sorts of things to you that aren't necessarily part of you, and we don't see the common ground anymore. You know, I think we need to talk about that. I think that, you know, that for example, as a mother, you know, I think that mothers all over America could relate to you because there's a commonality in that experience, as parents that we all have. But I don't think we look at that anymore. And I don't know why that is. I think we, you know, we put that label on you and then we ignore everything else that's about you. And, you know, when I was growing up, I said there was a thing about being an American. You know, we were always proud to be Americans. I hope that's still true, but I don't know if it is.
But to your point, where if we're successful as communities, and it's a really great example, water boards, school boards, public safety, public works, city councils, you know, we're working. I see it in my own city that they're diametrically opposed on some things, but darn it, they get things done. They figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, they pass laws and ordinances and zones and, you know, what have you. And it's working, even though they may disagree politically.
Well, maybe it's because we have to. You know, it's like a family. It's like, you know, you can get mad at your brother or sister. I mean, part of it's respect for that person. But part of it is also you got to come home at Christmas and see that, you know, you're going to be sitting at the Thanksgiving table with them. I don't know if that's part of it or not, that, you know, we feel like we're bound together, so we need to do this. And on a national level, we don't feel that same sense of urgency. I don't know. But I'll tell you my fear, and I want to move on to talk about this for a few minutes. My fear as a Democrat is that the Democrats haven't figured this out yet, and they're going to find themselves in a world of trouble come 2020 if they don't figure it out. You know, that I was deeply involved in the campaign that on the Democratic side, which we called the candidates were referred to as the Seven Dwarfs. There was Jesse Jackson and Dick Gephardt and Gary Hart and Mike Dukakis and you know, all these candidates, Paul Simon. And I said that to somebody a few days ago, and they said, the singer Paul Simon ran for president again. But, you know, all these people, right, that were involved. And we ended up with Mike Dukakis, which you know, was not our best candidate forward. Yeah, best candidate forward. So look at who we have now, just to start. We have Tulsi Gabbard, who just signed our petition, onto our legislation. God bless her. Julian Castro. I don't know if you know Julian Castro, but
the San Antonio mayor.
Yeah, and he was at in North Carolina when the convention was in Charlotte. He was like the golden boy. You know, he's a great orator, and he's not very well known, but, you know.
Well, there was a piece written about him this week, which is why he came on my radar. It was an op-ed piece through the USA Network, USA Today Network. Mm-hmm. And the journalist, I guess, has known him for 30 years and made that as a disclaimer, but was glowing in talking about him.
Yeah, he is an amazing guy. I mean, you know, and in the world of political candidates, you know, you've got to remember, for me, President Obama gave the keynote speech in Boston. I'll never forget this. He gave the keynote speech at the convention where we nominated Kerry in Boston. And somebody sitting next to me said, "Who is this guy?" And I said, "He's a senator from Illinois." Yeah. And she said, is he a freshman? And I said, yeah. And she said, oh, well, that's too bad, because he's a great candidate. He, you know, with a little more experience, he could be president. And I always kid her about that, because he was our next candidate. So you can come out of nowhere. You know, we certainly have seen that. But I don't know. He's a good candidate, though, I think. We also have John Delaney from Maryland. I have no idea who this man is. He was a congressman from Maryland. I don't know, but he's in there. And Beto O'Rourke, who people are just talking about as if he's the golden child. But I'm a little dubious. If you can't beat Ted Cruz, can you really win on a national level? I don't know. But you know what I think is really interesting.
Kamala Harris announced this week too.
Yeah. So that's what I find interesting. In the Senate, so far announced are Elizabeth Warren, Kristen Gillibrand, and Kamala Harris. So you have three women. No men have announced. Now everybody assumes that Cory Booker may get into it, and Joe Biden would get into it, and Bernie Sanders are all going to get into it. But so far, the only people that have announced are women. How interesting. I find that very interesting.
I think, do too.
Yeah. I think that they all think that this is a good time for women, and I agree with them. I think it's a good time for women too. I don't know. I love both Elizabeth Warren and Kirsten Gillibrand. I don't know enough about Kamala Harris, but by the way, just so you know, we've invited this member of Congress to be on our show. I don't know if she'll come. Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, is that her name? Yeah, from Ocasio-Cortez from New York City.
Yes.
Very outspoken. We've invited her to come on the show. I hope she will. But, you know, they did a poll last week that showed that like 70% of the people said they would consider her for president. She's not old enough to run.
She's 28.
I know. She's not old enough to run. But well, if she were...
She needs to censor herself a little bit, too, because she says things that are not very bright. And I'm sure that's the outtakes. Because I mean, how many of us were composed at 28, let alone did what she did? Right.
And that's it. I think she needs experience. And yeah, to say that, you know...
The three branches of government.
Yeah, or she wants all the cars off the road in 5 years, or, you know, rich people need to be taxed at 70%. She says some things that are really, really way out there. But I think that's an important voice, you know, I mean, as a single voice. But you're right. I think that because she's 28, I think that when she gets a little more experienced politically, that rhetoric will change, you know.
Well, and I don't know if you saw George Will's column about Warren saying that she could be the Democrats' Margaret Thatcher.
She could be the Democrats' Margaret Thatcher.
That's what he said. Yeah. He went into it, and it's fairly glowing, his comments about her. Because, you know, I guess he's fallen off the Republican thing since Trump got elected. So he's much more, shall we say, egalitarian in his thoughts.
Well, I got to tell you, one of the things that I hold against Senator Warren is that she could be America's Margaret Thatcher. You know, I mean, that's, I see that. I don't see that as a...
You don't? The Iron Lady? Thing. Oh,
well,
I do.
Tough. Yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, well, that's because she was a Republican. If she had been in America, she would have been a Republican.
Elizabeth Warren
away from Margaret Thatcher
for 4 years.
You know, but yeah, you know, I've got to tell this story since you mentioned Ocasio-Cortez's age. You know, when I was in college, I was a communist for like a week. You know, I was ready to join the Communist Party, and it was just before Christmas. And my sister, who had studied the Soviet system of government for years, you know, I was giving her a hard time about, you know, being a part of the proletariat. And we were very poor growing up. So at Christmas, when we started to make it in life, my sister and I, we would lavish each other with gifts. And so I came over on Christmas Day, and she handed me a card, and I opened it up, and it said, a large contribution has been made in your name to Socialist Collective 21. Merry Christmas, Daspidanya Patricia. And I said, what? And she said, well, there are no gifts in communism. And I'm like, what do you mean there's no gifts in communism? And she's like, no, sorry, honey, we all share. So, you know, and that ended my, I'm like, no gifts in communism. All right, I'm out of here. So I went back to being a loyal capitalist after that.
But, your sweet sister.
Yeah, she was a sweetheart.
So sorry that you lost her so young.
Yeah, and the end of that story, she gave me a whole bunch of gifts after that.
Oh, she made her point.
She wanted to see the expression on my face was like,
priceless. And look at what the effect it had. How many years ago was that she did that?
Oh my God, 40 years ago. I was still in college, I think.
And decades. Yeah. So I mean, talk about a lesson learned, huh?
Yeah, lesson learned. I never went back. When you're young,
that disabused you nice and quickly, huh?
Yes, it is. And you know, and she used to say, you can be wealthy and do whatever, you know, you can be wealthy and kind, you don't need to be wealthy and stingy, you can be wealthy and benevolent, you know. So, right. There's nothing wrong with being wealthy, it's really what you do with it that matters. And I certainly embrace that. So
well, my qualitative study last semester was, what is there about an individual that volunteers? Mm-hmm. Now, in your case too, what is it about you that is a civically engaged individual? What is it about somebody who gives their time, their treasure, their talent? And so we had to conduct interviews and then find out this blah, blah, blah. It was qualitative, so it wasn't coded and anything. And so what? And I said, the so what is there's tens of thousands of NGOs, 501c3, foundations, nonprofits, who are trying to make a difference in our world, either through a disease or an affliction or a population or a culture or what have you. And if we can identify how to better attract and harness that kind of individual, then these other causes could get more momentum and maybe start to heal things. And my, I don't think my professor saw that coming. It was like, oh, I see where you're headed with this.
Like, well, you know, isn't that exactly what we were just talking about, though? That, you know, on a personal level, here you get on a personal level, and you've got all these NGOs and these other community organizations and people that volunteer for stuff. And we know for a fact that Americans are the most giving people on the face of the planet, you know, as individuals, not necessarily our government, but certainly as individuals. And again, you know, we have that spirit in our community. How do we get that? How do we transfer that spirit to the national level where we all want to help and we all want to, you know, do things? I think there's a lack of leadership in America. I think that you know, people are dying to be led, and there's so many good people out there that are doing so many wonderful things. And I'll tell you, I volunteered my whole life. This isn't the only job I volunteered for. I was the head of my Citizens Association, elected neighborhood commissioner, volunteered at a food bank for 10 years. I've done all sorts of volunteer work. And the reason that I do it more than anything is that when I was young, I went through some very hard times, and there were many, many people that stepped up to the plate and helped me. And it made all the difference in my life. And I think of where my life would have been if it hadn't been for the people that reached out. And so I say I reach out not only because I feel I owe it and I want to give back, but also because you can make a great difference. You know, if you're out there building widgets, and how many of us build widgets? I mean, I ran a consulting firm for 25 years where I was in the background all the time. You don't ever know when you're part of a big piece, you know, you're a cog in a wheel, how much of an impact you're making. But you teach somebody how to read, you feed a hungry person, you help somebody that needs something. And I'll tell you, there's no better feeling in the world.
Well, and to that point, people have always said to me, because I've been a lifelong volunteer myself, and they said, why? And I said, I have to say, this is going to sound so selfish. It makes me feel good.
Yeah.
And I don't do it for that reason. That's a ancillary benefit of it, because I like to pay it forward. I want to give back. I have a sense of duty, gratitude, service, etc. But at the end of the day, I feel good when I've touched a life or lives or what have you. You know, I'm just one person on this planet. Yeah. But like you said, if you can help make somebody else's life a little bit easier or their road not as difficult or whatever, then it's a win-win-win. Everybody benefits.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's it. You know, there was a pop song last year called My Fight Song, or the year before. So I love popular music, and you know, it starts out by the lyric is like a small boat on the ocean set putting large waves into motion, and that's really what we can do as individuals, right? You make a small contribution and it tends to spread throughout our society, throughout our community, and it does make you feel good. It's not the only reason that we do it. No, just like you, we all feel a sense of obligation and paying it forward, and you know, saying thank you for all the things that are being done for us. I just got invited for example, to a veterans thing. Which is very inconvenient for me to go to, but I'm going because I don't know how to say no to a veteran.
Uh-huh.
How do you say no to people that have stood up for you, you know, to protect you? So there's a sense of obligation there, but also you're right. You just feel so good. I'll tell you what, man, there's no better feeling than standing there and feeding a hungry person. I've never felt anything any better than that. It really makes you feel worthwhile. So if you're out there, go feed somebody. That's what I have to say. And we're almost out of time. So Maria Sanchez, please have the last word.
Just to say that we are very grateful for the fact that you choose to find us, and we appreciate you listening and sharing the word, because we have informed, respectful conversations. And I think Michael and I can be role models, if you will, in some regard in that arena.
Well, I'm not going to argue with that. And now we're going to play a song in honor of all those people that were furloughed but still showed up every day to work to keep us safe. Thank you all. And let's not forget, this is a song from 1932, the height of the Depression. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.